Today we have on Lauren Pearl. She went to Boston University, has played various strategy and consultant roles in her career. She was the director of strategy and finance at Trail of Bits, CEO and co-founder of Roost Homes, and recently started Pearl and Elmore, which is an offsite programming company. She also teaches a class at NYU Stern on financial modeling. Welcome to the show, Lauren. Is there something founders should focus on?
So one of the first that comes to mind is it all comes down to the bottom line. Every single business in the world, your profit will be equal to your revenues minus your costs. Whenever you are doing activities in your business, it will result in some kind of impact in some part of that equation. And the idea behind metrics often is to connect those business activities to that bottom line so you don't always have to think in confusing numbers. Entrepreneurs who run things based on gut instinct, that's the unlock to try and get to before you really start growing your business, because it helps you make decisions, it helps you delegate, it really helps you grow and scale and understand what's going on in your business, even when it gets really complicated.
You gotta have something tangible that you can achieve. I gotta get 5 customers. Okay, how do I get customers? Channel 1, 2, 3, 4. Now you have a clear action and directive of, okay, for me to get 5 customers, I need to use one of these channels. What can I use? What do I have ready? What? It's a lot more tangible of action stream. Versus I need 10K MRR. I'm like, where are you getting money from? Like, what's the relation between a customer and 10K? Like, I like the idea of putting it as a tangible action because you can then derive things from there. Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place. Today we have on Lauren Pearl. She went to Boston University and did her MBA from NYU Stern, has played various strategy and consultant roles in her career. She was the director of strategy and finance at Trail of Bits, CEO and co-founder of Roost Homes, which was acquired. Since then, has played various fractional CFO roles before starting her own advisory CFO firm. And recently started Pearl and Elmore, which is an offsite programming company. She also teaches a class at NYU Stern on financial modeling. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thanks so much. It's so great to be with you.
Did I capture everything correctly?
Yeah, you did a really great job. I need to get those notes from you so I can do it as succinctly.
I like to start off all the interviews with one question, which is, when did your entrepreneurial journey start?
Sure. Well, for me, it's a funny answer because it started a bit before I was born, actually. So it started with my father. He was an executive at a kind of historic shoe company in Dexter, Maine for a number of years. And he quit to do his own journey, his entrepreneurial journey. And that involved taking most of his money and investing it in a Caribbean island called Montserrat. He was going to build hotels there with a bunch of partners. Unfortunately, a couple years after he did so, Montserrat was hit by a Category 5 hurricane that decimated the island. And then as they were trying to rebuild, a couple years after that, a previously dormant volcano erupted on the island and destroyed 2/3 of it, making it uninhabitable, which it still is today. So that investment was completely gone. And so very early on in my life, I kind of watched that entrepreneurial journey and also watched the impact to my family, going from being very comfortable to basically nothing. What then happened is my dad kind of had to make it work. So he started another business, this time operating in his field of expertise. So he started a shoe company. He actually bought a company that had gone under in Maine, one of the oldest shoe companies in the United States called J.L. Coombs. He bought it for $4,000 from a banker who'd already sold off all his assets, except for the name and 2 trailers full of old shoes. Nice. And he grew it from basically nothing into a 7-store retail chain throughout the northeastern U.S., so like from Maine to Massachusetts.
Nice.
And I basically grew up alongside this growing company my whole life, right? I learned how to write my name by gluing in inner soles and like writing my name in shoe glue alongside my siblings. I worked on the sales floor, in the warehouse, talked about employee benefits at the dinner table when I was like 12. That was just my normal. And that's really kind of where I got started, as entrepreneurship wasn't really like a new foray. That was, to me, just the default.
Nice. When you entered your professional life, when was the first time you're like, hey, let me go start something on my own? And what was that first thing?
Yeah, so that didn't happen for much later. Initially, I was meant to sort of take over the family business. So when I graduated from undergrad, I first went into like software. I didn't really think I wanted to do family business. I went into tech and was a front end slash administrator for a tech consulting firm in Boston. But then my dad was retiring. There was the option to take over the family business. None of my four siblings wanted to do it. Red flag. But I decided I wanted to. And so I went back and learned kind of the remaining roles that I hadn't already done before and took on kind of like a chief of staff role.
Nice.
What I realized was that the business, it wasn't doing well. Like things were going wrong, but I had no formal business education. So I couldn't quite figure out what was happening. And so I took two different kind of strategies to learn what I needed to know to fix this business. One is I applied to business school. And knowing that I might not get in, I didn't know anyone that had gone to business school, so I didn't really have an idea of how likely that would be. So I also went and worked for a different retail company that was doing well. So like, I'm going to figure out how to fix this problem either way. Got into Stern, luckily, and what I thought was going to happen is I thought I would like learn best practices and I'd learn the numbers and it would help me fix the business. And instead, I learned the numbers of business and how that stuff works. And they told me that this business needed to stop. It was bleeding money. It was in a dying industry. The kinds of things that could save it would be pivots that would require way too much finance. We weren't in a position to acquire that capital at the time. And so the business actually went under while I was in business school. And so I didn't start something of my own for a couple of years because I think Stern taught me how much I didn't know. And so it took me a while to feel comfortable breaking out on my own. I went and I worked at Deloitte Consulting for a couple of years in what a lot of folks at the kind of like top end MBA schools call like your fellowship years. You go work for one of the like
the big four. Yeah.
Exactly. So I went and worked on their strategy, retail strategy and tech transformation team. Then I worked for a very small startup, but grew it into like a bigger company. So Trail of Bits, when I joined, was 10 engineers, and I was their first business hire. And they were just kind of working on government contracts, and we grew them into a commercial company that now is, I think, maybe like 150 people and works essentially for like all of the big tech companies for cybersecurity engineering. And it was only after that, after I'd like done Deloitte and run a company and like proven to myself that I could grow it from like very small to like significant industry player, that was like, okay, now is the time. And that's when I started Roost, which was my first business.
Nice. Can you quickly talk about Roost and what Roost Homes did?
Sure. So it was 2021. I started Roost Homes with an architect, and essentially Roost Homes built prefabricated homes to the passive house standard. So essentially like those homes that you see, if you're like driving down the street and you see a home that's like a part of a home that's driving down the street because it's been built somewhere else and is going to be dropped on site, that's a prefabricated home. The passive house standard is an extremely sustainable standard for home engineering where it's really energy efficient. It retains heat really well.
Yeah.
And so we saw this as sort of the way forward for single family homes. And I kind of got this idea. I was at Trail of Bits. I was trying to think of what I wanted to do next. It wasn't really continuing to grow with the kind of pace that I enjoyed. Yeah. This seemed like a good idea. And honestly, I left Trail of Bits to kind of clear my head. And within a week, I discovered that NYU, my alma mater, had a startup incubator program and applications were due like in a week or 2 weeks. And so I quit my job, put together a pitch deck, submitted the pitch deck, and then like under a month, I think, I had funding.
Nice.
So that was sort of my test of like, okay, this is worth time. I will devote some time to this. And we essentially spent the summer into the fall to trying to prove out traction for the idea. And during that time, you know, we built out the foundation of the business. We found vendors that could help us build these homes. We found our first kind of customers that were willing to take a chance to build homes in this way. We found that a lot of investors were interested in this type of business. This was kind of a growing part of that industry. A lot of these startups were coming out of California, but had slightly different take on it. So we fit in really well. But by the end of the fall, what I was noticing is that a lot of the customers real estate is tough. Not everyone who says they want to do something ends up doing it. And my partner wasn't really interested in taking on investment. And so there was a path for this business, but that wasn't the path I wanted to walk. It ended up getting acquired by my business partner.
How do you go from MBA, Big Four, Trail of Bits tech company to getting into fractional CFO in the finance space? Like how, is that something you're always interested or how did that transition happen or why did that transition happen to doing financial CFO related stuff?
I honestly kind of fell into the fractional thing. I'd been serving as the CFO of Trail of Bits for a while, sort of in practice. There's no one else to manage the finances, so I was it. So I kind of learned how to be a CFO on the job. Okay, Stern's also a very heavy finance school, so that was a big piece of what I was kind of training my master's to do. So it wasn't, I didn't feel uncomfortable taking on that role. But as I was starting Roost, I realized like I need another income stream, especially if we're not considering taking on investment because those sales cycles are really long. Yeah. So I did it kind of to make ends meet. And Roost had like lots of interest from investors, but not enough interest from customers. And my fractional services were exactly the opposite. Tons of folks were reaching out, wanting that kind of service, wanting that kind of help, getting, you know, a financial model together, understanding what it took to get funding or just to make the business viable. And so it just kind of took off and became my full-time job.
You teach a class at NYU, right? Can you talk quickly about what the class is and what you focus on in that class?
Yeah, definitely. So I work with the Berkeley Center at NYU. As an alum of their program, I'm very, very appreciative of what they gave me when I was sort of starting my own break off on my own entrepreneurship part of my entrepreneurial journey. And essentially every semester I teach a course on financial modeling. It can be for any kind of business, but it's mostly geared towards the kind of financial model you build when you're fundraising that you're going to present to investors. And we dig into, it's kind of designed that if you've started a financial model, that's great. But if you've done nothing, you should leave that course with the tools to know what steps you have to take to build that model from the very beginning to the very end, including how do you build a model that you can sit in front of a VC presenting this model and you won't freak out because it's something that you're comfortable with. And also a model that when you then are operating the business because you did amazingly and you got funding and now you're a CEO, you can also use that model to run your business, which you should be able to do because models are really hard to build. So you don't want to just throw it away when you're done raising money.
So it's safe to say you've worked with, mentored a lot of startups, whether early stage or seed stage, right?
Yeah, I was counting the number of startups that I've worked with since I started doing FRAC. And between teaching at NYU, I also advise with NYU. We do a monthly help desk where folks come to me essentially with their models and I'll troubleshoot what's going on with them or answer any questions they have. Between that and my business, I've worked with, and I'm estimating around 150 different startups in the past couple of years.
Nice.
So yeah, I've spoken with a lot of folks kind of without realizing it.
So on that train of thought, what's some common financial mistakes you see these early stage founders making? Is it lack of some knowledge? Is it, I don't want to say immaturity, but like ignorance of like, oh, this doesn't matter? Mm. And a follow-up to that question, is there a particular skill or area within this financial space that early stage founders should at least try to learn or focus on that would help them later on in their career?
Okay, starting with the first one, what financial stakes do early stage startups typically make? So one of the first that comes to mind is just about how much money you have to invest in your first MVP.
Yeah.
My first course that I taught at the Berkeley Center before we realized that modeling was such a need was a course on shrinking your MVP. And it's essentially like, it's a common concept that you hear in Lean Startup and in like 4-hour work week, but this idea behind your first MVP doesn't even need to be software, 100%. Right? If you're building a tech tool, your first MVP, ideally you don't build anything. You spend very little money. And the whole thing is like, you're trying to get research. You're trying to essentially test assumptions, 100%. Right? When you have a value prop at the very beginning, it's a guess. Right? It's a guess at what value you're going to bring to your customers. And inherent in that guess are a bunch of assumptions of things you believe about the world, right? It's a proposition.
Yeah.
And so the first MVP is meant to test those assumptions.
100%.
So if you simply isolate what assumptions you're making, right? What assumptions are you making with that value proposition that if true would make your startup a really good idea, and which ones, you know, if false, would completely devastate your startup idea, making it not viable.
Yeah.
Those are the ones you have to test, and you don't have to necessarily build software to test those. And so I would run founders through all of these exercises to kind of brainstorm different ways to do that. Because it's really hard to convince a founder not to build software if they're already convinced they want to do it. It's also like fun, it's exciting, you want to do your dream. So the kind of constraints we'll talk about are like, okay, let's even shrink this down even little. Maybe it's reasonable to say you're going to spend, you know, your crazy plan is going to cost $30,000 to build out the software you want. You know, a reasonable plan might be, okay, let's think about what would cost $3,000. But the really good way of thinking about it is like, say you have to build something or do something that will test as many of your assumptions as possible in the next 24 hours. What do you do, right? Say you can only spend $10. What will you do? It's like you shrink it down even smaller than the resources you actually have to force yourself to get creative on like, what you can do to just get a little bit further. So it doesn't sound like a financial mistake, but it is, because it's sort of spending too much to execute what you need to, which is simply proving out the assumptions before you go and you spend more money. I'd say that's one of the biggest things. The second financial mistake I see startups make comes up when they're modeling their business, and that's vastly underestimating the cost of distribution. A lot of times, when you build a financial model, or you watch someone else build a financial model, a founder, you discover what they think is going to happen in the business, because that's what a model is. And oftentimes it includes kind of some mystery around how customers show up, right? So like, oh, I'm going to have a 5% month over month growth. And the question's like, okay, yeah, but from where? Yeah. Like, you have to do something, you know, and there's, you know, I think this idea is starting to go away because there's a lot more education around this for early startups. But especially when I started teaching this course, there was a lot of sentiment of like, well, if it's really great, it'll just go viral. If it's really excellent connecting with customers, people will just buy it. And it's like, no, you have to explain. Yeah. you have to explain whatever it is you're doing to customers, and getting in front of customers and having them listen to you costs money. So you have to budget for it. And it these days costs more money than you want it to. So you have to budget significantly for it. So yeah, I'd say that's like the other one that I still see some founders make.
I can heavily relate with the MVP topic that you were talking about.
Okay.
Because with the agency, folks come to me saying, I want to build the XYZ. And I'm like,
yeah,
well, that's like $200,000 worth of software. You don't even need that. Like, you have no validation. You got to go focus on idea and problem space validation.
That's right.
Is there someone available? And I keep telling founders, and it's bad for me as an agency to say, don't do this, because I'm basically canceling a potential contract.
Sure.
But I don't want you to spend money building a product no one wants, or no one's told you they want.
Yeah.
A lot of first-time founders I see this more common with, they just think people will buy, like you said.
Right.
Like, people will come when I build it. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
No one's going to come. You got to go educate. You got to go solve the right problem.
That's right.
For it to make sense. But
that's right.
Heavily related. I could talk about that for hours.
Totally.
and the second question. So, is there something founders should focus on? So, like, traditionally, non-tech founders are advised that, okay, if you know how to use some no-code tools, you can get by with your MVP.
Yeah.
You don't need a CTO. But for someone starting out, are there certain skill sets in the financial space that would help them a lot that you've noticed, and also help you down the line raising funding?
Yeah, I think knowing how to connect what you want to execute to metrics is really, really powerful.
Can you expand on that a little?
Yeah. So when you're just starting, it's hard to kind of understand what results in actual progress in your business, right? Like, it all comes down to the bottom line. So, like, we talk a lot in the financial modeling course about the profit equation. For every single business in the world, your profit will be equal to your revenues minus your costs, right? That is how businesses work. Yeah. And whenever you are doing activities in your business, it will result in some kind of impact in some part of that equation. And the idea behind metrics, I think, often is to connect those business activities to that bottom line, so you don't always have to think in confusing numbers. So, for example, you might in your business need to spend like, you know, $10,000 a month to keep the lights on. And you know that you need to make at least 10K in revenue in order to hit that metric. But not all businesses work where, like, thinking about it, 10K every month is an easy thing to think about, right?
Yeah.
Like, say you have a recurring revenue model, say you have a bunch of, you know, complex channels. There's another number that's going to make more sense when you're running your business that translates to that ultimate goal. And so I think as a founder, when you can quickly connect to, I know I need 5 more customers, and have that kind of relate to the bottom line, like getting that sort of business driver thinking, I get to this level and it means success for me, and I can see that through line throughout my business. I think that's one of the key lessons to becoming a really good leader of your company. So you need to see that through line. And then as you start to take on employees and team members, it also helps you delegate, because you understand kind of where everybody else fits into the picture of your business. It helps you communicate more clearly what you want out of them and the consequence of them hitting or not hitting their goals. From a financial understanding, if you don't already have that through line, and a lot of folks don't, if they don't come from a finance background, a lot of them have a good gut instinct for it. And this is, I think, also where you see entrepreneurs who run things based on gut instinct. It's the beginnings of this that they already have, but they just might not have either the vocabulary or the connection to what you might see on a report to kind of bring that into the scope of like the language of business. So if you don't already have, I think that's the unlock to try and get to before you really start growing your business, because it helps you make decisions. It helps you delegate. It really helps you grow and scale and understand what's going on in your business, even when it gets really complicated.
I like the way you put that, because the way I'm interpreting that is you got to have something tangible that you can achieve, right? So you gave the money and customers example.
That's right.
I got to get 5 customers. Okay, how do I get customers? Channel 1, 2, 3, 4. Now you have a clear action and directive of, okay, for me to get 5 customers, I need to use one of these channels. Okay, what can I use? What do I have ready? It's a lot more tangible of action stream versus I need 10K MRR. But like, where are you getting money from? Like, what's the relation between a customer and 10K? Like, how much is each customer paying you? Is it recurring, not recurring?
Yeah.
And so I like the idea of putting it as a tangible action, because you can then derive things from there.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think interestingly, like, I'll meet founders who have it's almost like a spectrum. Like, I'll meet founders where they feel more comfortable in the tangible, and I need to help them get to understanding how that tangible has to do with like common metrics like MRR and CAC and like these other kinds of things that might belong in a business model. And then certain founders, it's the opposite direction. They come maybe from like a consulting background or like a marketing background, and they've been used to these kind of like metric-driven ideas of the way that business works, or these kind of like abstract ideas of measurement of success.
Yep.
And you need to translate for them into like, but here's the actual things you need to go do. 100%. Here's the number of conversations you need to have with distributors before one says yes and you can get to customers. You're like, so I think for every person, the journey of that education can be a little different depending on what you feel naturally most comfortable in.
Makes sense. So going back to the course you teach at NYU, and it's a course about financial modeling, right? Can you briefly explain what the basics of a financial model are and how someone should go about building a financial model?
Yeah. Financial model, broad strokes. Okay. So basically a financial model, the very basic, is essentially a picture of your hypothetical business before your business exists. That's how I kind of define it, as distinct from like a financial forecast, which might, for an existing business, describe what you think is actually going to happen in the business given some data that you already have. So it's sort of an abstract story in Excel of what's going to happen, how the units and money will flow through your business and result in profit. Picture looks a little different for every single business, but almost every business shares certain benefits from building that model, right? First of all, if you're hoping to be a venture-backed business, it unlocks funding because you need to build one to talk to VCs. But it's also, I think, that one of the best benefits of building it is if you don't have a company yet, it's one of the first moments you get to test drive your business because you get to see the things that will impact your business. Is this a high margin business? Is this a low margin business? How many customers am I going to have? How many channels? Is cash going to be tight every month because my sales cycle is long, or is it going to be flush and like building up over the year? And this is great because building a model, it's not building a business. You're just putting stuff in Excel and you get to see as a founder, like, do I want to run this company or does this company sound like not a good time, yeah. right? So that's why you build one. And what I find is often the case is some founders luck out. They are comfortable in Excel already and they're model whizzes, so they can just build it right in Excel. But I find most times founders and like folks with a banking or accounting background don't tend to be the same people. Like there's a really different risk profile there.
Yeah.
And models are kind of challenging. Like this isn't an easy model to build. So there can be a bit of a paradox there where it's like, okay, I'm building a challenging model in Excel, but almost by definition, if I'm a founder, I'm probably not a modeler. How do I get it done? So what I recommend to the founders I work with is to actually start outside of Excel. And at the risk of sounding like a boomer, I recommend people actually start like on paper to take out like blank computer paper basically and a pen. And the first step would essentially be starting with the profitability equation where you know like the model is profitability is essentially what the model is going to calculate. It'll look at a couple of other things, but the profitability equation, the revenue minus the cost and what you'll have after is the most kind of important piece, I would say. So you're basically taking that equation and you're saying, for my unique business, how does each of these pieces happen?
Yeah.
So revenue, how do I make revenue? And in this piece of paper, you're basically listing the words of the things in your business happening in math. So it's going to look a little bit like what it would look like in an algebra class or like in a math-driven science class where you're like, okay, my revenue is going to be equal to, say you're selling, you know, shoes, for example. It's going to be equal to like the number of shoes that I sell. So like number of shoes times the number I've managed to sell each month equals my revenue. Am I getting revenue anywhere else? No. Okay, great. Revenue's done, right? And then on the cost side, like, okay, each of the shoes cost me a certain amount to make. So that's kind of my unit cost. So I'm going to multiply that by the number of shoes that I, not the shoes that I sell, but the shoes that I make or buy. Different number. Cool. Write that down, right? And then like what other costs? Okay, costs to run the business. These are all your fixed costs. And you kind of write this out on that piece of paper, it ends up looking a little like a tree because any of those individual units, like you might have to dig in more. How much does it cost for a shoe to be made? Well, that might not be a straightforward answer. Like, okay, let's think of all the components. There's the shipping, there's the materials, there's the what have you. You might kind of circle that variable and on a different piece of paper say like, oh, I'm also going to have to calculate this. So you're creating kind of this picture. I call it mapping your math. It's like this picture of how you're going to have to calculate this thing. So then you have it. So you're done, right? Each of the variables you have kind of to the point where you can at least take a good guess on any one of them. You either know what you're going to use for the input or they're in a space where you're like, I don't know it, but I can make a not crazy guess about this. Once you're there, you have someone else review it before you go in Excel because everyone who looks at Excel, even people who work Excel all the time, when you see an Excel spreadsheet, your eyes glaze over, especially one that has a lot of mistakes in it.
Yeah.
So you get a review as well in that kind of format. And only then, once you feel solid in your math, once you've made decisions about how you're going to calculate stuff, then you move to Excel. And once you're there, you already have a solid idea of how you personally want to calculate things because, and this is really like important, it's I think very key to finance for early stage founders, every person thinks about the math of the business differently depending on where they come from. So like the way you've decided to calculate those things as you've described on paper is going to be different than a different person who comes with a different background and thinks about those numbers in a slightly different way, right? So if you have it written on paper and it's not like easily deletable, it's too much to erase, you're more likely to then, when you go out in the wild and you want to build a model, everyone goes and looks at templates, which is fine. But if you already have how you want to calculate things, you'll be looking for tools that can help you do it the way you want to do it. And you won't be force fitting your brain into someone else's template and way of thinking and getting confused. So that's generally the process that in my 2-hour course at NYU, I walk founders through, and it's seemed to work. We do it every semester. Everyone ends up having a model by the end of their time with the Berkeley Center. It's really doable. as long as you're building the model in a way that makes sense to you rather than something that made sense to some accountant who put a model together.
When talking about startups and founders, and I'll limit to tech startups because that's what I know, and them needing to build a model, how good does the first model need to be?
How good does it need to be?
And so I ask from the point of view of, let's say I'm building out a model, right? Maybe I want to raise money 6-8 months down the line, right? Because I need to know things I don't know for me to be able to write down cost and for me to be able to write down revenue.
Sure.
And yes, I have an idea of where we are today.
Yeah.
But is that the right way to build the model? Or do I have to be futuristic in, I'm going to raise, I'm going to have employees? Like, fixed costs have a lot of notions. You start getting software, you start buying software.
Yeah.
Those are costs you maybe are not thinking of.
Yeah.
And how do I go verify that, okay, if I've done this mapping exercise, have I captured everything? Is it the correct amount of information to start the model?
That's a good question. So it seems like there's actually kind of two questions. One is around like, which assumptions do I use? Like, which inputs do I use for the variables I'm already thinking of? And then like the second is like, what if I forget variables?
Yeah.
So I think for the first question around like using the right inputs, I think the best models are built to assume that those inputs are going to change when your information gets better.
Got it.
So for any given startup, you don't need actuals. If you're like pre-seed or seed and you're talking with your first investors and a business doesn't exist yet, you don't need inputs from your actual business for the most part. You can use them if they're useful and helpful and like a proof point that you can talk to an investor about because they prove some point you're trying to make about what you think is reasonable. But you can have all of those inputs be based on what you've seen in the market, based on research, based on other founders you've spoken with. And as you speak with folks about your model, the model should be able to quickly change them without breaking everything.
Got it.
My favorite kinds of models have all of the inputs actually like in one section where it's easy to like quickly copy paste different kind of scenarios. So you could imagine if you're talking to a VC, you've got your model and it's got all of the assumptions you think are true about your business. And then you're going to talk to the VC and they're going to be like, "Yeah, actually, you're saying churn's going to be like 0.5%. Try 4%. That's reasonable for your business." So in your model, you should be able to be like, "Okay,
let me make it 4%.
Let me make it 4% and let's see what happens to the profit and loss statement that I've modeled out. And does this become unprofitable? Does it not? Okay, if it does, maybe we have to go back to the drawing board, what have you." The model should allow you to learn from the insights of others around what those inputs could be. Because no one knows, but everyone's going to have different information, different opinions, and you're going to learn more. And if you have a model to talk about, you actually have the tool that allows you to have that conversation because someone can see all the assumptions you're making and course correct you if they're not right. And actually, I think that's where your second question comes in of what if I forget inputs? It's that feedback. If you create a model that's good enough that it makes it clear what assumptions you're making, you are exposing yourself to the ability to get input of, hey, dummy, you forgot marketing, right? Like if that's not one of your inputs and it's not on there, someone's going to tell you that if you speak with enough folks about it. So when you say good enough, I think what makes a model good enough is it's reviewable.
Got it.
It lets you learn. It lets you put in new inputs. It lets other people give you feedback about the business that you think you're going to run so that you have better information when you get around to doing it.
In terms of, you talked about updating a model to take into feedback, account different variables, missed variables.
Yeah.
Even before getting to that stage, how do I know I've built the right model? You know, are there signs? Are there things I can refer to? Because I could define my profit loss model a certain way, but maybe I didn't account for a factor that should be accounted, so I add a change. Mm-hmm. But how do I know that that model works for the business and the space and is giving me the right assumptions? Because if I start basing all of my decisions off of a model that is slightly inaccurate, then it affects a lot of stuff downstream, right? So is there a way or recommendation you have for folks to hone down on that model and just make sure you don't have any leaks in the model?
You mean like mistakes?
Probably. I mean more mistakes, yeah. Because unless I'm working with a certified professional or a CFO and I'm early out, I'm just learning and doing things myself, how do I verify it's the right model?
Yeah. Okay. So my answer to that is Even if you are working with a CFO or an accountant or someone who works in Excel every day, if your model is complicated enough or long enough, it's probably going to have mistakes.
Okay.
So like there's this person, I can't remember where I heard this, but like years ago when I started to use a lot of Excel, someone, a finance professional who would talk about when it's right to start moving to software would say, basically, if you have a model over 100 lines long, you should assume there's mistakes in it. And I think that's really interesting. It's just like software. There's a model is software, right? There's bugs in it. You know, you can get it vetted by a professional, just like you could get a piece of software audited. Yeah. You can have people review it, and that helps, just like having folks review your software helps.
Feedback.
You'll
it's
find
just
bugs.
More feedback, yeah.
Yep. But there's also like best practices, just like if you were writing software, there's best practices for writing good code, there's best practices for writing good models. Number one, I would say, is keeping it as simple as you possibly can. Like, the fewer lines, the better. The more simple, the better. So fewer lines is kind of objective, but it's also like, make sure it's a model that you understand. You want to know how things are calculated. You want to know where inputs are coming from. If you have multiple sheets, you want to be able to click a cell and look at the formula that's in there and be like, okay, I know how this is working, right? You never want your model to be so complicated that you look at it and you're like, I have no idea what I was doing in this formula. I just hope it works. Like, that is a recipe for disaster. So simple, you understand it. Other, color-coded. So you want to have your inputs, things that you can actually edit by just typing a different color than your formulas. And there might be other color schemes that you use. For example, like I like to gray out any columns that describe data for things that have already happened, because I like to know whether an input is like a guess versus an input is like an actual number that I'm recorded historically. But you can use color to kind of remind yourself what the different parts of the model are, because if you type over a formula, things will break. Yeah, I think those will get you a pretty long way just by keeping it simple, making sure you understand it, formatting it correctly. The final one would be potentially, if you have a moment where you can't keep it simple or something gets a little hairy or complicated or a little what we call in modeling speak bottoms up. Tops down would be like you measure something with a metric like 10%. My operating costs will always be 10%. That's a tops down assumption. Versus listing out all of your potential operating costs and like calculating them all together, adding them up, figuring out the total, and then saying, okay, what percent is that total of the thing that you're measuring, right? So if you're doing a bottoms up, there's a lot of inputs. A lot of times things could go wrong. When you have to do that in a model, when you know there's an area that's potential for mistakes, you can also implement like a check. So a check in a model looks like you have a total that's got calculated in like a really complicated way, thinking through what's another way I could calculate the same total with a different set of data so that I can add something in two different ways and realize that something's broken if the two numbers don't match.
Makes sense.
So you can also do that if you know there's an area of your model that's like prone to mistakes.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned color coding. I like that tip. So a question that maybe will help some listeners is, do you have tips or advice on how someone should get good feedback on their model outside of just being, go look at this and tell me what's wrong? Mm-hmm. Like, are there tips or advice you have for me to get really constructive, direct feedback, and how someone should go about that?
Yeah. Feedback in what way? Like what kind
on the
of
model.
Feedback are you
so
looking
like,
for?
Is the model built out correctly? Have I missed assumptions? Are my assumptions valid? You mentioned the churn example, like I'm doing 0.5% churn. This industry typically is known to have 7%, right?
Yeah.
What's the right way for me to go get these specific points of feedback on my model so that I can plug any holes that I may have?
Yeah. Again, it goes back to making sure your model is optimized for review. So inputs are the thing that you'll be most often refining, probably. And so having those all in one kind of central area makes a lot of sense.
Makes sense.
A lot of the best models I see have like an entire tab devoted to just inputs. And actually, that's really cool because if your model has an entire tab devoted to inputs, you can do this cool thing where in either Google Sheets or in Excel, you basically open up two instances of the model. And you can put them side by side, one with your inputs tab showing and then any other part of your model. So you can like update your inputs on one side of your screen and see how the totals change on the other. I think that's a great way to review your model with someone because they can look both at the inputs that you're creating and their impact on your business. So someone with some like experience in the industry can like have both sides of that context when they're giving you advice. Yeah, I'd say that's sort of the best way to do it.
Sweet. I like that. Some questions I like to ask every guest I have on. Mm-hmm. Do you have a particular startup stack or tech stack that you use to run and operate your businesses? An example, some founder just use, they're just Google Drive people.
Yeah.
They just use Google for everything. Some people use Notion plus Jira plus Slack plus whatever. Do you have a preferred stack that helps you run your business efficiently?
Yeah, I am definitely a huge Google user and definitely use Google Drive, Google Meets, Gmail, all that sort of thing. I was recently introduced to Superhuman, which I'm kind of obsessed with and think is really good. Yeah, what are some other ones that I use a lot? Anything beyond that, I think, really vary from business to business. One of the things I've noticed, I don't just work with like venture-backed tech startups. I work with startups all over the spectrum. I work with small businesses. In my offsites company, we work with medium to large businesses. So we see a lot of different types of companies. And I think sometimes you'll get an answer on tech stack from a founder of a startup where it's like, oh, you just use this, you right? Like they have like a list of like, here's the quick hits of all the tech that you need to use and just do that and you'll be fine. And I've so been burned by one of those lists before because it's really unique to your particular 100%,
business. 100%.
So I would almost treat like your tech stack, especially if you're on a minimal budget and you don't want to confuse everyone, I might even treat it the same way you'd treat like an MVP where you're kind of growing your tech stack as you're discovering things that work for you.
Yeah.
And letting yourself be kind of nimble based on what is really a good fit for you and your team and less like beholden to like the coolest new thing, the thing that everybody else is using, the thing that everyone else is comfortable. Like it's all about you and what's going to make you most efficient.
Yeah, I like that. Do you have a support system and what is your support system that helps you run multiple businesses, do a course, mentor startups? Like I feel like everyone needs a support system and it's not talked about enough. Mine's sitting right behind the camera. But what's your support system?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, like you, my support system definitely starts at home with my family. My partner is also a business owner and going through the journey together has been just irreplaceable and wonderful to have kind of a co-conspirator in that. And we have an amazingly cute dog named Naya who's there for pets whenever I'm stressed. So that's super key. I think also the startup network in New York is really wonderful. And there's like a lot of peers that I reach to that are really generous with time and information and kind of being in that journey together. In my support system too, I think a lot about kind of just like the pieces of my life that help me sustain. I am a big pottery person. I really love making pottery. And so as much as that's hilarious because it's a really time consuming and stressful hobby, but actually it works for me because I need a stressful hobby to drop the stress of my normal life. And it takes a lot of time, but that's okay because it kind of constrains the amount of time where I could spin my wheels and forces me to really have that pressure of like make a decision, do what's most reasonable, go. So that's also really key for me is like something else I'm passionate about that has nothing to do with work gives me a lot of energy.
Do you have a setup at home and a wheel or do you go to a studio?
I go to a studio, yeah, which is great. There's other people there. They're all creative. It's like totally different world.
Nice. We did a 6-week pottery course and we have so many gifts we're going to give away.
Yes.
They're shitty pieces that nobody wants, but it's handmade, so you gotta take it.
Yeah.
Sweet. What are three resources that you would recommend to people listening? This could be a podcast, a book, a blog, anything that you would recommend.
Yeah. I think, first one, a book. I really like the book, The Founder's Dilemma. It's a little dense, but what I like about it, and it's a little old too, so it's a little outdated, so grain of salt taken, but it's really great at describing the data behind the different paths to becoming a startup versus small business. It talks a lot about the best co-founder to pick and like statistically what works out. It talks about the difference in the payoff between if you go like the VC back route versus if you go small business route. It's just kind of like talks about these things in a hypeless way based on data. I really like that as sort of like something that you have to read before becoming a founder because I think it starts you with eyes wide open. So that's one. Two, I really love the In-Depth podcast by First Round.
Okay.
They have a great, so their podcast, they're always speaking with, especially if you're a VC-backed startup, but it's helpful for anything, I think, in tech, because they're talking to folks in startups that are further along about really tactical things that worked for given teams. Like, how did you handle distribution of this particular thing? How did you handle like your feature backlog during this certain time? And they like get really in the weeds. So I feel like it's a great place to just get ideas of stuff that's worked well. It's, again, and I feel like this is a common theme of things I recommend to folks who are in the startup land. It's not very hypey. It's not like, and this crazy stuff happened. It's very much just like, this is how I do this. This was the result, which I think is so nice. Valuable in this industry where there's a lot of like fluff and glamour and hype and marketing and stuff that isn't like that. Or big like sweeping generalizations that might not be true for you without context. Final thing that I would recommend. I think if you are starting a startup and haven't read Lean Startup, you need to.
Highly recommend.
But hopefully you already have.
Yeah.
And that might be my third one.
I feel like a lot of folks enter the space and someone recommends, and like, oh, let me go read this, right? But I feel like reading it once every 1 or 2 years gives you a very different perspective.
Yeah.
Because you relate with different things, different chapters, and probably due to reread it at some point. But I like rereading books like that as well.
Totally.
Once you've gained some perspective on stuff.
Totally. Yeah, I think too, maybe like a more general book recommendation that...
Venture Deals?
No, well, yeah, Venture Deals is good. Venture Deals, actually, I'm adding recommendations. You should take the Venture Course. There's a Venture Deals course that happens like once a year that they put on. You can take it for free and you can like learn in a course. You can also read the book, but I haven't read the book. I took the course. I've heard from someone who's read the book that Sand Hill Road is actually a bit better and gives you a better inside look on VCs and how they work and their motivations. But the course was very good.
This is a course by the Venture Deal guys?
Yeah, the Venture Deal guys do a course.
Okay.
It's once a year. I think it might be in the summer.
Okay.
And you can take a peek. If you look up Venture Deal's course, it'll pop right up. So recommend that. But no, my recommendation was going to be, if you're starting a startup in a new industry that you aren't in, I feel like it's another kind of common mistake that new founders will make of they're going to disrupt an industry, right? They're going to come in and do that. And I saw this all over the place in the real estate business when I was doing Roost. Like, all these tech folks were coming in like, I'm going to fix housing and I'm going to do it by running it like a software startup. And they all fail.
Yeah.
I started my company with an architect, so I had a big advantage. And from that architect, I was learning how much I didn't know. So I went and read a ton of books about like real estate development, passive house construction, syndicating, like how like REITs work, like all of this like stuff in the industry. And there was even construction, like how you build a house, like read tons of stuff around that so that I'd actually get a feel for like where I was coming, like the industry that I was coming into and how much I really didn't know about it and how far I had to go. And I think some founders like go straight to talking to customers and skip that step. And it's sort of like, why wouldn't you? There's so many folks who've come before you. You're not going to ruin your good idea by learning the old ways of doing things. You're only going to give yourself better information. So that might be my other recommendations. Like, nice. If you're going into a new industry, read the books for every player in your industry so you don't have these like vast blind spots that you'll end up bumping into later on when you have a lot more at stake.
Yeah, 100%. I like that. I ask every guest to give me a question for a future guest. And so your question for my last guest is, what is one thing that you would absolutely dedicate the rest of your life to?
The rest of my life? Oh my gosh. Maybe what I'm doing now. I mean, I've been in startups literally my whole life. So I've already kind of dedicated my life to this with like a brief foray into Deloitte. But I think it's like beyond startups, I think helping teams of people like make it work in this economy drives me very strongly. Like helping them get through the hurdles of getting what they want to accomplished brings me joy and kind of feels like my purpose. So,
and this is not in specific to finance, just in general, getting over hurdles or?
Yeah, I think that's true. I've chosen finance sort of as the vehicle for delivering value at startups because I think it's where there's sort of the biggest gap
100%.
In learning. But I've only been in finance sort of a small portion of my career. Before that, I was just more of like a generalist operator.
Yeah.
And the finance component of how I think about businesses is very helpful, but it's just one of the tools that I use to kind of help clear the path and make it make sense. So
nice.
Yeah.
What would be your question to whoever my next guest or future guest is?
I want that guest to say what drives you to do what you do. That's my question.
I like it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Of course.
I had an enjoyed conversation.
Me too.
Where can listeners find you? What are you working on? Do you want to quickly talk about Pearl and Elmore as well?
Sure. Yeah, Pearl and Elmore is a brand new thing. So Pearl and Elmore, basically in my Frack CFO practice, I essentially help business owners one-on-one transform their businesses, make more money, basically learn how to wield the numbers to run their business better. Yeah. With Pearl and Elmore, I've paired up with a psychologist from Columbia University to essentially bring some of that into the realm of teams, dealing with larger companies, medium to large companies, global teams, and remote teams. And essentially, we've realized that in this remote working environment, the offsite or the team retreat, the time when people come together in person, is this untapped, really important moment where you can get so much done. And so we're really laser focused on thinking through, like, how do we make the offsite experience, that conversation, the most ROI positive investment that the team makes all year? How do we make sure they talk about the right things, create the right unlock, so that that like chart of growth for the year is like cruising along, hit the offsite, and there's your hockey stick.
Yeah.
How do we make those moments happen? So we right now are looking for teams who are doing offsites. This is something that folks are already planning. And so it's really something new to kind of, you might have thought you're just going to kind of go surfing or hang out or like talk about the vision for next year. Instead, if you want to try and use that time to really accelerate your business, that's who we want to talk to. So if you know anyone having an offsite who like wants to get more out of it, let us know. And we're at pearlelmore.com.
Nice. And what's the best channel for listeners to reach out to you if they have questions or want to reach out for any feedback?
Yeah, you can reach out there. You can also reach out to me via LinkedIn. I also do a newsletter, which is pretty cool. I do a daily newsletter, which sounds intense, but it's not. It's basically, like, if you've ever read like Seth Godin, he does a daily blog that's super, super short and just kind of a little like, oh, that was a nice thought. That's what it's like.
Nice.
And you can also join that. It's called the Daily CFO. A bunch of finance tips and kind of goodies for just how to run your business more effectively. And anytime you want, you can reply straight to me and I'll answer just in an email as well. So that's another way to get in touch with me.
That's cool. And we'll link everything in the description.
Awesome.
But thank you for coming on. This was a really good conversation.
Thank you so much. I agree. So great being with you.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button and I'll see you in the next episode.